Kind of an idiot puts that on his luggage.
Such a good movie. Sorry. All right, so we're going to talk about godly things today. Anyway, I want to walk you guys through the land. I gave you guys all maps that we'll get to in a minute. Those are for labeling, okay? I will put that map, if I haven't already, in Dropbox. So if you're like, it must be done a certain way, okay, you'll get another one. It's okay. So I know certain personality types are that way, me included. And I'll tell you what you need to know. I'm going to walk you through a bunch of stuff that's not on the test, but I want you to understand Israel. I went through seminary and never got a lesson on Israel in terms of geography and the place and where stuff was, and I'd hear about cities, and it was just kind of like this, I'm imagining like what could be, and then all of a sudden you get over there and you realize everything I thought was wrong. Like, that's not right, because nobody walked me through any of it. So there's obviously nothing as good as going to the land and walking it and seeing it, but I think pictures and some geography and some understanding of where cities are and such will help you guys a bit, especially as we get into Kings and Joshua and conquering the land. It's just really important, and there's so many details in the text that talk about it, and forever I just skipped over them because they were all unimportant to me because they didn't make any sense. So, but they are huge clues for all that. So, welcome. We're glad you're here. No worries. Aaron called me last week. I was just going into the bus. He's like, hey, I'm outside Troy's house. He's not answering his phone. What do I do? It's all good, man. Life happens. All right. So with that, Proverbs 6, 9 through 11. This will be reminiscent of another one. And in fact, this proverb hung above my bed for 4 years in college. So it's a gentle reminder to me. And as you read it, you'll see why. So Emily, read that if you will. Proverbs 6, 9 through 11. So, how long will you lie there, oh sluggard? Did we do this one? We probably did Proverbs 24. A little, or did we do this one?
Sounds like we've done this one.
I remember you saying it was butter.
I did?
Yeah.
Dang it, why didn't I check it on my list?
Sorry.
I hate all of you. I don't have a backup proverb today, it's Friday.
Proverbs 5, adultery.
The whole thing? You just want to rock through the whole thing?
Oh,
gosh. Is that 5 or 7? 7's adultery.
No, it's 5.
He has it stapled on his wall.
Warning
against adultery. Oh, man.
You know what? Ain't nothing wrong with that.
Warning against adultery. I mean, I'm
warning.
All right.
Dang it.
25, 27.
You know, I had another one in my head today.
Was it 32 water?
No, it was 20, because in honor of the 20th. It was 20.
Wait, they both are.
2021. Turn there. We'll go off the cuff here. Dang it. Okay, yeah. So I had that one above my bed. Thanks a lot. But you guys paid attention. That's good. That makes me happy. Half of you knew that I taught that before. The other half were like, no, that's brand new. What's wrong with the rest of you guys? That's just rude. 2021. Emily, read that one. And fake like you haven't heard it before. Now I'm double. Have we talked about this one?
No,
okay, good. All right. An inheritance gained quickly. What is that called in reality? What is inheritance gained quickly?
A lot of will.
Something like that, a will. If a parent does that to a child, what is that called?
Spoiling
a child, right? This is the spoils of victory. That's where we get the term. So as we're looking through Deuteronomy and Joshua and the spoils of victory of battle, that's where the term came from. You go into battle. You wage war, you win the war, you gain an inheritance that you didn't work for, the spoils of victory. Same with a child. What's the end result of that when you are able to possess something that you didn't work for and that you didn't obtain, if you will, by hard work? What does God say about something like that? Yeah, it's invaluable, right? If you don't put in the sweat equity for something, it loses its value. If you don't have skin in the game in terms of be it stuff or whatever it may be, there's not ultimately the sense of value that there would be if you would work for that. If it was money that you had to invest or time that you had to invest or sweat or whatever it may be, that's the idea. Remember this as you guys are raising kids. Suffering, difficulty is a good thing to teach kids value, right? Our kids at times will want certain things, and we'll make sure that they have skin in the game to get that. So if it's some big thing or some little thing, we'll make sure that, hey, mommy and daddy will match that, or we'll do whatever we can to help you with that. But we want to make sure that they are invested in that process so that they can have a sense of their own desire and reward. Okay, have you guys heard the story of old Paul Harvey's story, if you've heard of that guy? He talks about a guy that's watching a butterfly coming out of a cocoon for the first time, and he sees this butterfly struggling to get out of the cocoon, right, after it had been encapsulated for however many months they do this, and helps the butterfly get out, right, thinking he's doing some good. Butterfly gets out, and then he watches this butterfly get eaten immediately by a bird. And he's telling his buddy about it, and he's like, yeah, that was really a bummer. You know, I was watching this butterfly, and he was struggling, so I let him out, you know, to help him out of his struggle, and then he immediately gets eaten by the bird. And his buddy, who knows more about this process, tells him, hey, the reason that happened was the purpose of them having to struggle out of the cocoon, it wipes all the gunk, whatever the theological or biological word is for that, off of them so that they can fly. And when you rob them of the struggle, you rob them of the opportunity to get all that stuff off them, and then you basically handicapped or retarded the growth of that bird or of that butterfly so it got eaten by the bird. So point being, I don't know if it's true or not, but it sounds really good, doesn't it? Anyway, fits. Yeah, don't let the truth get in the way of an illustration. I learned that too. It's not important.
It's teasing.
Yeah, it's 32. We'll get there. Anyway, so as we think about struggle, as we think about what God's allowing his people to do, especially after Deuteronomy, reading through what God allowed his people to go through, he could have picked a different route, right? He could have got Israel in the land in 2 weeks. He chose not to go that route. He could have taken them through simpler roads. He didn't. He allowed them to suffer and to struggle. And for one generation, it didn't help. For the second generation, it's going to help a little bit more. But as you guys think about that, remember that. God is a good God. That struggle is important. And to be robbed of that struggle is actually doing a disservice to us. And it's a disservice to your kids. As you guys are parenting, as you guys are discipling others, help people to embrace pain, to embrace difficulty, and those seasons of life. You know, we don't want to live there. We don't want to set up camp there, build houses there. But we want to embrace those seasons of the ups and the downs and recognize that's part of God's plan. All right? So embrace the struggle. All right? There you go.
So when my friend's grandmother died, tell him, embrace that. I'm just playing.
That's a part of life, man. It's, you know, it's hard. You want to sympathize with people, but, you know, it's... Yeah. Just quote Romans 8:28 to him. That's don't do that. Yeah, that was sarcasm. All right. Let's talk about Israel, shall we? You guys are going to want to be able to see this. So, Katie, I'm pretty sure you can. As comfortable as that seat is. You guys may want to get to a place where you can see the screen. I can turn it a hair. So you guys tell me if.
We'll move.
Want to get an x-ray or something?
Is that a little helpful? Yep. Rest of you guys. Let me kind of move my junk back. Can you see through me?
Yeah.
Mas or menos? Does that work? Okay. Good. All right. So, again, in front of you, you've got your map. And I just want to walk you guys through big picture stuff. So some of this stuff is not necessarily important for you. We teach this to every group that goes to Israel every year to orient them to the big picture flow of the land. Many of you probably are not going to Israel with us, but I hope some of you will whenever we go again. I have no idea when that's going to be, so it's like 3 years from now maybe. We'll see. But these trips are of great importance and have literally been kind of like the fifth gospel for me in a lot of ways. It just brings the text to life in a way that you can't imagine. Okay, so sit back for most of this, enjoy it, listen. I want you to process it and know some of it, but I'll point out the areas where I really want you guys to be able to dig in and label stuff on your map. Okay. So some of these maps you've seen before, again, this is modern-day Israel, okay, or modern-day Middle East you guys have seen. So kind of the Mediterranean Sea to our, 9 o'clock over there, Israel on the coast over there. Southwest of them is Egypt, obviously Saudi Arabia, countries that we're familiar with, Iraq and Iran. You got Syria to the northeast, Lebanon to the direct north of Israel, Jordan directly to the east, again, all enemies of Israel. Some are choosing to be friends, but all of them are basically Muslim-dominated countries that are not friends with Israel. So, do you have a question, Joseph? Nope, just praying.
No, we didn't pray.
Perfect. Oh, we didn't pray. Is that what you were telling me? Then we should.
Thank you. Will you? Sure. Forgive me.
Heavenly Father, we thank you for this day that you have brought to us and allowed us to enjoy. We pray that you would use us to bring you glory. And we ask that you would help Mike facilitate the instruction of understanding and better understanding your people, your land, and the promises that you have given to us. We thank you for everything that you continue to provide for us, and thank you for this weather that you have so graciously allowed us to enjoy. And we just ask, Lord, that you would continue to develop us and allow us to enjoy the Proverbs 20:21 of our life. And in all these things we pray in Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thank you, sir. Appreciate the reminder. Okay, so modern day Middle East, okay? Not a ton to show you there, okay? This is during the Assyrian Empire, so don't so much think about the shaded area, but I just want you to show you the countries that would have been around during that day. Sorry, I'm going to move this just to here.
It blinked.
Yeah, weird. Like, our relationship's always a little sketchy, so I try to reestablish it every year, buy flowers, but it's dicey, okay? Obviously, Egypt, we know, to the southeast, okay? You got our friends Edom, Moab, the Ammonites, the Aram, which is where Damascus is, immediately around Israel. Sumer, where Abraham's from, you guys remember, Ur of the Chaldees is down here. This is the Babylonian Empire, where Babylon was, and then Assyria is to the northeast, okay? Here's Nineveh, Jonah's capital, or where he came from, and the capital of Assyria, the Assyrian Empire that obviously extended to the north. So some major countries that would have been around during Israel's day. We'll get to some of those during the king's time, but I just want you guys to see kind of the surrounding areas. And again, all folks that are going to be at odds with Israel at some point or another, okay? Babylon is the country that comes in 586 and defeats the south and wrecks the temple. Prior to that, Assyria comes in and destroys the northern portion of Israel in 721 BC and wrecks that. Both of these countries are going to be going after it with Egypt. There's kind of this constant battle for control of this entire area from these three countries. And we'll see Israel kind of caught up in the middle of that a lot of times, trying to make treaties and different kings that are trying to make nice with these countries so as to not get destroyed. Okay, so big picture stuff, okay? This is the map you guys have in front of you, okay? So a couple things I just want you guys to be aware of. You've seen this before, and I'll walk you through some details. But if I were to ask you on this map specifically, to the sea to the west, what is that? Mediterranean Sea, okay? This guy is what?
That's what I figured.
The Sea of Galilee.
Yeah, you serious, Siri. I buy the obvious extended to the north. Some major countries that would, like, what? Not talking to you. Go away. All right. Sorry.
Obviously.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Is that what she said? Now, Siri and I need to DTR. Okay. What sea is this? Galilee. Okay. This is the Joseph?
Dead Sea.
Very good. Okay, Dead Sea down there. Okay. The river that runs from the Sea of Galilee into the Dead Sea is what? The Jordan. The Jordan. Okay. See, that's like half your labeling right there, okay? So that's what I want you guys. Those are major geographical landmarks. Mediterranean, Sea of Galilee, Dead Sea, Jordan River, okay? Know all those. We're going to add to that in a bit, but those you guys are very familiar with. And we'll go through maybe one city in there and a couple other things to put on there, all right? But that's the big topography of Israel, okay? So a little bit about geography just in general. How big is the land of Israel, okay? 263 miles long, so top to bottom. So if we go from the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, where Eilat is, way down south at the bottom of the Negev, all the way to the north up into Dan, north of the Sea of Galilee, 263 miles long, and then 9 to 7 miles wide, east to west, okay? In terms of different places on the map where you are, 9 to 71 miles, I should say, east to west, okay? Now, I just got through reading a book, by the way, called A Case for Israel, which is all about modern-day tension with the Palestinians, the two-state solution. So if any of you guys have read about that in the news, it's a fantastic look at that. And one of the big issues that the UN and other folks have with Israel currently is the current borders that they have. They took over an area just to the east of the Sea of Galilee called the Golan Heights, okay, which is basically a gigantic plateau that extends upward from the Sea of Galilee and then plateaus at the top that used to belong to Syria. And then in 1967, during a war, Israel won that. They were attacked. Israel kept that land when they won the war and won't give it back to Syria. Okay, and there's some issues with that from different governments and different countries around them. Okay, so however you feel about that, irregardless. But when you have a country that's 9 miles wide, why would you feel the need to take land to the east and to the west of you? Why would that be important defensively? How quick can you fly an airplane from east of Israel into Israel when you're 9 miles wide? It takes like 45 seconds to go across the entire breadth of the land, okay? So if you have enemies, like Israel does to your east, you obviously need to find defensible locations, okay? Is high ground or low ground defensible location?
High.
Okay, so we're going to see that. Israel, for years, they had built what are called a kibbutz, which are basically like, think like a hostel, a communal village on the edge of the Sea of Galilee, and directly up the hill from them was Syria. And they would literally lob mortars, Syria would, down in these kibbutzes and kill people, right? And they would have to deal with that all the time. So you're on your way to work, and all of a sudden you're dodging bombs. Literally. That's Israeli life. So when they had the opportunity to take that land, they said, yeah, thank you very much, we will. They controlled that entire plateau and pushed Syria back further east so they could defend their land in a more appropriate way, okay? So anyway, if any of you guys are interested in modern-day Israel stuff and the discussion that's going on, that book is really good. It's called A Case for Israel, okay? So to give you a perspective of kind of how that would fit within California, that's the land, okay? That's the land of Israel. Basically, kind of like our Central Valley, it fits in there a little bit bigger, obviously, but kind of quite nice. So that's the land compared to the cities or the state that we live in. And if you put it in my home state, it, you know, basically goes from Dallas to Houston, north to south. Okay, pretty tiny. And then just overall, as you think about how insignificant little Israel is, I mean, like it doesn't even show up on the map, right, on our scale of things. So fascinating how tiny this little country is when it's all said and done. Okay, now, here's the map I want you guys to begin to label. Why is it so blurry, by the way? That's awful. Oh, well, sorry, guys. So I want you guys to begin to think through some of the regions. As we've talked about with Israel, there are very distinct changes in geography as you move from west to east or east to west in the land, okay? And it changes like within a mile. All of a sudden, you're in a very different geographical location, okay? So as we start from the Mediterranean Sea, we've got the coastal plains that obviously hug the Mediterranean Sea. Next to them, we have what's called the Shephela. And next to the Shephela, we have mountains. And then next to that, we have the wilderness. Okay? So, coastal plains, Shephela, mountains, wilderness. And you'll see this on a couple more maps, so if you don't get it all right now, it's not a big deal. And then next to the Jordan River Valley, we've got the Rift Valley, which is what the Jordan Valley is in. Okay? So these are the four geographical kind of barriers. I'll show you pictures of each of these, what they look like and why they're important. And then we have a couple other valleys I put on here. One is the Jezreel Valley. This is where the city of Megiddo is in. Armageddon, the hill of Megiddo. This is the Jezreel Valley. It's the biggest open area in Israel, the biggest plain, if you will, of open space. And then north of the Sea of Galilee, there's a place called the Hula Valley, like Hula Hoop, Hula Valley. And then down south, way down here, is the Negev, right? The southern area of Israel, which is the desert, okay? You got that? Okay, so we'll walk through each of these. Okay, now here's kind of a cool topographical map of just to give you an idea of how dramatically things change, okay? So as you look at, again, the coastal plains would be right down here next to the sea, okay? Think Carmel, Pismo, right? Very similar to what we live in. Okay, coast, beaches, nice area. In fact, the hotty-totty houses out in Israel obviously are out on the beach. Okay, so the people that have a ton of money, Prime Minister of Israel has a house out there. There's a golf course. It's like one of the only golf courses in Israel because golf courses take up a lot of land. They don't value golf, right? So you have to have a ton of money to be a golfer in Israel. Okay, next to that, in this green area, is the Shephela. Okay, that is the Shephelah literally means low hills. We actually see that word mentioned in the text. It's in Deuteronomy. Okay, it literally means low hills. So think in California, that's our growing region. It's our area of green. It's where we would have grapes, some kind of rolling hills, but not getting up into the foothills yet. Okay, that's the Shephelah. And then next to that, you get now the Judah Mountains. Okay, they start kind of just like ours as you're moving up into like up Aubrey Road towards Shaver. You're getting into foothills. We're not talking about China Peak Mountains. We're not talking about some of the, you know, the 14ers that we have out here, but we're talking about low hills. Okay, Jerusalem is on a high point in the Judah Mountains, and I think it's like 2,300 feet above sea level. Okay, and it's one of the highest areas in this geographical area of Israel. So we're not talking about huge mountains, but we are talking about from sea level to Jerusalem is a 2,300 foot elevation change. And then you're going to dive immediately down into the Rift Valley. Okay, so there's a story about a man that was coming from Jerusalem to Jericho, the Good Samaritan, as he's walking from his duties in Jerusalem down to Jericho, which is basically right where 24 is. I think that's actually, is it? Judean wilderness. It's close to this area. Anyway, that drop-off is like 3,300 feet in elevation, okay? The Dead Sea is the lowest place on earth. I think it's 600 feet below sea level. Is that right? And the depth of the sea is, maybe it's 1,300 feet. Anyway, it's the lowest place on earth. But that drop is a 3,300-foot drop in like 9 miles, okay? So it's significant. So again, just this geography of the land is, it varies quickly, okay? So just to give you a bit of the topography there, okay? I'll show you, okay? Great question. All over, to answer your question. But that star, by the way, is Jerusalem, okay? So as you guys orient yourself to key cities, if you basically go directly west of the top of the Dead Sea into kind of the top of the mountain chain here, that is Jerusalem, okay? So just want you guys to be aware of where that city is in relation to everything else. There you go. More Jewish. All right. So let's talk through kind of these areas again. Okay. That's the coastal plain. All right. I want to give you a word to associate with each one of these areas. Okay. So when you hear coastal plains, I want you to write down the word Philistines. Okay. Philistines lived on the coast. Okay. They were a Phoenician people. They came from the west. That's where their name came from. As we see some of their archaeology, some of the stuff that's associated with them, they were a seafaring people at one point that migrated into Israel over time. They're great at war, iron, horses. We talked a little bit about that yesterday, but they lived on the coast. Okay, so Philistines. So when you think Goliath, when you think the story of David and Goliath, that's where Goliath and his family would have lived. So cities like Gaza is in the coastal plain. Ekron, Ashdod, okay, cities like that that we'll see in the text. As we get into the Samuels, you'll see those cities, right? A whole bunch of cities that mean nothing to you right now, okay? But coastal plains, think Philistines, right? Right next to them, you've got the Shephelah, which literally means low hills, okay? I want you to think the word battles, okay? These are where the majority of the battles in the text between the Philistines and Israel take place. A lot of that stories that we'll see that we read about battles that take place are generally in the Shephelah, okay? Again, Shephelah means low hills, very green, very lush, very desirable land, okay? That's the Shephelah, okay? And then we move up into the Judah Mountains, okay? Would have been this area. So immediately into the Shephelah, bordering that is the Judah Mountains, and then Jerusalem obviously is encapsulated in that. I want you to write down the word God's people. This is where the people of God, during the period that we're about to read about, generally would live, okay? So, if you've got the people of God that live in the mountains, and the people of not God, Philistines and whatever, live in the coast, the battle would take place when they're both trying to push into each other's land, okay? So, it's really interesting as you look at history to find out who controls what portions of land, you can see who's influencing. Okay, so for instance, during Saul's day, Israel is going to occupy the smallest territory of land that really they ever do, because the Philistines are encroaching from the west. They're pushing in. They're pushing Israel to live further up into the Judah Mountains. They take control of the Shephelah, and they lose a bunch of land to the Philistines. Now, during Solomon and other times, Solomon and David will push out with battles, push the Philistines back into the coastal plains, and they'll own a lot of the Shephelah. Okay? So the Shephelah over time, excuse me, becomes kind of the thermometer for spiritual health of the land, right? If Israel owns the Shephelah, they are the ones doing the influencing. If they don't, they're being influenced by the culture around them. Does that make sense? So it's a fascinating geographical area, and you just look at who owns it and say, okay, you are the people that are dominating culture right now. Arts, history, all that stuff is either being done by the pagan or by the Christian, if you will. Okay, so it's not that cut and clear, but it is pretty fascinating to look through history and see who owns this kind of area of land.
Now, is the Shephelah identified in the Bible by calling it like low hills or Shephelah?
Okay. That word is literally in the Hebrew. So it'll say low hills in our text, and it's the word in Hebrew, Shephelah. Yep, so it's actually in the text, which is kind of cool. Okay, so Bethlehem is just a little bit east of that, still up in the hills, but a little bit further east. Okay? Southeast. Is that right? Yeah. All right. And then the last area, the Judah wilderness. Okay? Again, this is the area that drops off dramatically in elevation change. Jericho's at the bottom of that, down to the Dead Sea. So again, from Jerusalem down to the Dead Sea, about a 3,300-foot descent down, okay? I want you guys to think the word temptation. When Jesus goes into the wilderness to be tempted, this is where that area would happen, okay? This is, by and large, uninhabitable land. It's not pretty. Shale rock everywhere, hot. It's mountainous, and the terrain changes a lot. There's no real good sources of water out there. It's not very inhabitable, so not many people live there unless you're like a desert monk, okay? Which we do see some that actually take up occupation out there, different cities. We've heard of the city of Qumran, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. It's in this area, okay? Really, really hot in the summer. You got to be kind of weird and isolate yourself from normal people if you want to live out there, okay? So some of you may enjoy it. I won't call any names. Okay? So, think temptation when you think about the Judah wilderness, okay? And then the last area is the Rift Valley. What just happened? Go back. I want that one. Okay, thank you. Okay, Rift Valley. Jordan River. Okay, the Rift Valley, this is part of the Syrian-African Rift, okay? This is like a 2,000-mile valley that runs from Europe all the way down into Africa. So it is a gigantically long valley that stretches across continents, and the Jordan River happens to be a part of that, okay? So, again, below sea level, Dead Sea is the lowest place on Earth, and that's kind of part of that geography, okay? So that's the Rift Valley. Not a word associated with that, but that's where the Jordan River is. All right? Make sense? So you got coastal plains, Shephelah or low hills, the Judah Mountains, wilderness, and then the Rift Valley moving from west to east. All right? And then obviously we've got Jerusalem kind of landmarked in there just to give you an idea of where that is. Okay?
Is the Rift Valley where those canyons are?
Yes. You'll see where
those people pretty much die at because of the rain?
Yes.
Wadis
are what those are called. Absolutely. Okay, those were the flash flood comes. So if it rains in Jerusalem, Jerusalem's a watershed, so water's either going to go west or east. When it comes down to east, it flows through different canyons, and it is insane. If you guys ever want to watch some really, really cool YouTube videos, Google like Israel Wadi storms or something like that. They move cars. I mean, it's insane. In a little bit of rain up top, and all of a sudden you've got massive flooding. And you're, you know, putting tons of water through these really small openings. That they have to go down a certain way. The water's channeled, and literally will blow up cars and whatever. We were in Jerusalem one year and got caught in a flash flood in June, which is like unheard of. And ended up pushing some European out in their little like Fiat that had driven through, you know, a parking lot that got flooded in like 30 minutes, and me and Brad and Chris Beer out there in the rain pushing the, it was just one of those memories. You're like, okay, here we are. So, but yeah, their flash floods in there are insane. Okay. So it's pretty fascinating.
What are their houses like?
What are the houses like? Today or then?
Today.
It depends where you live. Like some of the nicer places, they're going to have the majority of the building in the Jerusalem area is all done in limestone. Everything is in Jerusalem. It's mandated that you build the externals of your house with limestone. So everything is kind of that yellowy rock color. It's beautiful. And then within different areas, they'll kind of use the local building stuff of what's there. Jerusalem is not plentiful. Sorry, Israel is not plentiful with trees. They've planted a lot. That's part of the Jewish culture, is to plant trees. It's a big deal because they don't have a lot. So they build a lot out of stone. Up north, they have what's called basalt stone, which is like a black, almost looks like volcanic rock stone. And then as you get further south, you get into some of like some white limestone and other stones. But they build a lot out of that stuff. Houses are pretty simple. You're not going to see a lot of elegance. I mean, some of the houses that we have here just in our cookie-cutter track homes are far nicer than a lot of the homes over there.
Do they have neighborhoods, or is it not really like that?
They do, yeah. Again, depending on where you're at. Like, so our guide, Ronen, lives just outside of Jerusalem in a town called Ar-Radar, Hill of the Radar. I think it's what it's called, because there's a radar-like dish on it. That's why they named the town after it. Whatever. And he lives in a really nice neighborhood. His wife's a geologist, so they live in a really cool neighborhood. Neighbors, they have a lot of... they'll have gardens and stuff like that, so they value kind of different stuff. Houses are close together. You're not going to see a ton of, like, sprawling land or things like that. So none of you would go over there and be impressed by, like, wow, these houses are, like, off the hook, right? We live in pretty lush areas here. But they're nice. They're great stuff. And, again, depending on the geography, they build around that. So, and I'll show you some ruins this morning of old houses and kind of what they look like. Very different, obviously, than what we live in today. But, yeah, so there's neighborhoods, and they're pretty compact. So one of the fascinating things that you can see, Israel has a high value of the land, okay, just because they have this tie to the text that they feel like God is... they're tied to the land in a way that other people aren't, right? So they value the land. So they plant trees. They clean the areas that are very high in taking care of this area. It's quite clear when you're leaving a Israeli-occupied city and you're moving into another area of town that primarily isn't Israeli, that may be Palestinian or whatever it may be, the way that they take care of the land changes. And you don't need to tell people. All of a sudden you'll see trash in the streets, you'll see homes that are decrepit and aren't taken care of, the smells change, and it's like, wait, what just happened? Like literally a minute ago we were in a really, really nice neighborhood, and now we're driving through some place that I'm pretty sure I want to take my kids, and those feels change. So it's fascinating. So anyway, it's one of the values that Israelis have, so it's cool to see how they take care of it when you're over there. Okay, got that so far? All right, so this is a review. Okay, coastal plains, Shephelah, Judah Mountains, Judah Wilderness, okay, and then lastly, the Rift Valley, okay? So here are some pictures just to kind of give you an idea. So this is the coastal plains. Again, coast, that's the Mediterranean Sea to our left. And then this is the coast, right? Flat city, cities like Tel Aviv are on the coastal plains, Haifa, if you've ever heard of any of these places in the news, that's coast, okay? So flat, green, nice, bigger cities that are there, okay? And then this will change into what's called the Shephelah, okay? You see all the growing areas. This looks very California-esque, yeah? I mean, there's grapes, there's all kinds of different stuff that's grown, but when you grow stuff in Israel, this is where it happens. Fertile land, green, gets good rain, that's the growing area, great soil. And can you see how quickly, by the way, this is the Judah Mountains right there. Can you see how the geography changes, the color changes? It's that fast. So east to west in Israel, you can drive an hour and go through two or three different, like full-on climates. It's bizarre, okay? So just to the top of the screen, that would have been the Judah Mountains, okay? This is what they look like occupied. So as you talk about cities, this is Jerusalem and some of the surrounding areas. So we're up in the Judah Mountains. You can see big universities and buildings. I'm trying to remember where the Temple Mount is.
We can see it in this picture. This is the Temple Mount right there. Can you see that little gold dot where my finger is? None of you guys can see it. I'm right next to it. I can't see it. This is the whole Temple Mount complex right here. So you can see in Jerusalem how closely occupied everything is. And within certain sections of the city, you've got specifically in Jerusalem different corridors of like, this is Armenian, this is Muslim, this is Christian, this is Jewish, even in the city. And they'll set up shops that way. It's been that way for hundreds and hundreds of years. But you can see the buildings and such are very tightly compacted in this area. Jerusalem has, I think, like 800,000 people that live there. The whole country, by the way, has about 8 million people. Okay, think about that. L.A. has 10 million people. The whole nation of Israel is at 8 million people. Okay, so you've got this little tiny Jewish state, right, that lives in the midst of 1 billion Arab and Muslim dominated communities with North Africa, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, right? They are the only Jewish state. So very much the minority in the area that they live in, okay? So that's the Judah Mountains, okay? Now you can see, this is Jerusalem. Just now, further on to the east, you see how that topography changes again. There's no houses, there's nothing out there. It looks dry and barren. That's the Judah Wilderness, okay? That's where people don't want to live. And that's what it looks like. Okay, you can see just to the edge there, the southern portion of the picture, a few homes, but then it gets into this, like, just nasty stuff. Okay, so when you think, again, wilderness in the text, we talked about this before, but this isn't Hume Lake wilderness. This is barren nothing wilderness. Okay, the Negev looks similar to this. I'll show you some pictures of that here in just a second, but this would have been uninhabitable for the most part.
So what about the houses that kind of live on the edge of that? Do they feel that heat, like...
For sure. Yeah, they're not going to be as pleasant. Now, Jerusalem's still hot in the summer. I mean, it'll hit 100 degrees in the summer. So it's not...
Is it like...
Yeah, we're like, hey, hot. So, and then every now and again, it's like Fresno, it'll snow once a decade, you know. So they'll get a little bit of that. But yeah, they can live there because they're close enough to water sources, but much past that, and it's uninhabitable, okay?
Was it where they wandered?
No. That was in the south, and then the Negev. Okay, and I'll show you that here in a second. Okay, and then obviously next to the wilderness, we have the Rift Valley. Can you see those cliffs and how quickly that descends? So as you think about passage and how you travel in Israel, you can't just walk off here and then start descending a cliff, right? You have to walk through. This would be a wadi, okay? So a cut in the land like a canyon, and you could walk at the bottom of that wadi, and that's where the road would be. You'd have two walls on each side. You've got shade, okay, but that's the only place you can walk. Now, the problem is, if it rains, that's the last place you want to be because there is a flash flood coming, and you will die. So, anyway, so travel and stuff like that's important to know the different routes.
How big is the, flood? Like, how much does it fill up?
It looks like Niagara Falls, like at times. When it's dumping in Jerusalem, it is insane, the amount of water that can move. It's
a guaranteed death.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're in there, you're going to die. And a lot of people, they'll do rock climbing and rappelling off some of these big deals. It's really cool. So as long as you understand the weather there doesn't matter, it matters what's happening in Jerusalem. So if it's raining in Jerusalem, you know you've got 45 minutes, an hour, before you're underwater. And you're channeling all this water into one little small area, and that's how it has to descend. Okay. So as we talk about, why did Abraham always take this route? Why are there only a few different ways around Israel? Well, the geography determines that. It's not some big open plain. You're in mountains and cliffs and those sorts of things, so you have to travel the way that the land allows you to travel. Okay, so that's the Rift Valley. This is the Negev. Okay, you guys have seen pictures of that. This is southern Israel. Okay, and it just looks like a bunch of that. Big, open, hot rock. Okay, way uninhabitable. Okay, it all looks the same. It's varying degrees of awful, right, based on how far away you are from water. Okay, now the Bedouins, Abraham was a Bedouin. They lived here. They lived in the Negev. Beersheba is in the Negev. Okay, cities like that where they would kind of hold up. Abraham, Isaac, all lived in this area. But they were close to water. This is where the sheep would pasture and that sort of thing. So as you think about even sheep, the pastures of sheep and the shepherds don't live in the Shephelah, right? They don't live in the green area. They live in the Negev. So when you read texts like Psalm 23 that says, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," it's not because God said, "Here is a gigantic, green, lush land. Go enjoy, sheep." The shepherd literally had to take you from green pasture to green pasture because you don't eat here, right? Now, the shepherd knows where there's water, and the shepherd knows where there's food. And every day he would lead the sheep to eat and to drink. And if the shepherd didn't do his job, guess what? You die, right? So it's a really cool picture of like, oh, like that. That's what it means to be shepherded. God doesn't open up this like Microsoft Windows green landscape hill screensaver, right, that we've seen. This is what always comes to my mind, right? That's not the picture of sheep and shepherding. Okay, this is where the sheep and the Bedouins lived.
It looks like Arizona and Nevada on
steroids. Yeah. That's yeah, like when you're driving through the Mojave, it feels just like that. Rocky, hot. You're like, what are those burn marks on the side of the road? Oh, those were cars that caught on fire because they overheated. Like, that's this. Exactly. So, because of where we live, like, we're very fortunate to have pictures here of what this looks like. As a Texan, I'm like, grapes. Right? This is very different. California's climate is very similar to Israel. Different seasons, at times it gets, you know, whatever, but for the most part, we can imagine have stuff that's very similar to this. Okay, they don't have the high mountains that we do. Well, they do in the north, I should say. They have one place where they can snow ski in Mount Hermon. For the most part, east to west, down where we're looking currently, this is the geography. Now, okay.
In the background of like Abraham and him being trained in Ur and places like that, I mean, it's completely north, a completely different terrain.
Yeah.
How would he have known how to read this terrain and look for water? Like, is there signs?
Well, Sumer's east, right? So Ur's that. The Haran, where he traveled north to come into the land, was up, but to the east, that's Babylon. So yeah, he had the Euphrates, but he's also living in modern-day Iraq, is where he grew up. So that's still desert, very similar to this. So yeah, he would have had to understand botany and all those things that Rick walked you through. That's why when he came into this land, he understood how to find water, where the routes were, all that kind of stuff. So directly transferable to living here, okay? So beginning to make a little bit of sense? Okay, so again, as a review, just to show you guys can see this, these are the areas that I want you guys to know, okay? The big geographic changes, west to east, okay? Coastal plains, Shephelah, Judah Mountains, wilderness, Rift Valley, and the Negev, okay? I don't think I mentioned the word, by the way, with the Negev. I want you guys to think wandering, okay? And you've heard that one before, but that's kind of the word that you would tie to that, okay? So, coastal plains where the Philistines live, the Shephelah or low hills, that's where our battles occur. The Judah Mountains are God's people. That's where the Jews primarily lived. The wilderness, again, temptation. That's where Jesus went to be tempted. Rift Valley, which is where Jericho is, on the Dead Sea, lowest place on earth. And then finally, the Negev in the south. Think wanderings. Okay? Now, you guys good with that? Do you need that up for a little bit longer? Good? Okay. Let's talk travel routes real quick. Okay, we've mentioned one that you guys have seen before, but I want to mention another one that was by far kind of the most popular, okay? The Via Maris was the way of the sea. So if you're going to travel north-south in Israel, you really have three options, okay? Which one did we talk about as we were moving through the end of Deuteronomy? The King's Highway, okay? Which was over here, right? So you had all the way down at Eilat down here, it started. You could go over to Egypt that way, and then you would move north up through kind of hugging the Dead Sea and walking through some of the wadis and canyons over there. That's called the King's Highway. It goes all the way up in Damascus, which is here-ish, okay? But that was one of the north-south travel routes. The more popular and easier route was the Via Maris, okay? It hugged the coastal plain, went through cities, and was a little bit easier to travel, okay? So that's kind of the couple of the sticky points I want you guys to think through. So anything in terms of trade, in terms of commerce, industry, thoughts, ideas, okay, they all travel down this road. So if you're coming from Egypt and you want to sell Egyptian cotton up in Europe, you're coming through this way. So to live on that trade route gave you access to ideas and things. It gave you power. If you're someone like Matthew, who's a tax collector, you set up your toll booth there, right? You make money because that's where people are coming. It's the hot spots of the city. And I want you to notice a couple of the cities that they roll through. We'll talk about these cities here in a second. Gezer is one of four cities I'm going to show you of significance. Megiddo, okay, Armageddon in the valley, and then Hatzor up to the north. Okay, and one of the cities that's not directly mentioned here is just north of the Sea of Galilee. Capernaum, Chorazin, and Bethsaida are in this area. Okay, Jesus did a significant amount of his ministry in this area. In the Via Maris, rolled directly through his like discipleship base of his core before he moved, or after he moved out of Nazareth and lived there. Okay, so Jesus lived on, in that day and age, the I-5. Okay, all information would have flowed north, south, out of there. So if you're trying to start a revolution and with ideas and messages, this is a great place to be because you're going to interact with different people. You're going to have the vehicle to take your message different places. Fascinating why Jesus or why God had Jesus set up shop specifically in that area. Okay, so just want you to know that word. There was one other travel route called the Way of the Patriarchs that literally was a mountaintop route that was kind of more down the middle, and it went through Hebron and some different cities in that area. Much more difficult to travel, but it was one that the patriarchs were known to travel as well. But again, the major ones were the Via Maris, the Way of the Sea, and the King's Highway, which you've seen. Okay.
And most of the traveling was by foot or by camel or by donkey?
If you had money, you had an animal. So a donkey or a goat or something like that. That was a status symbol. Okay. If you didn't, you hoofed it. So that was that's kind of the way it worked, okay? So Gezer, Megiddo, Hatzor up there, you guys kind of see the cities that they roll through. And then you got, obviously, on the other side of the area, the Transjordan side, you've got the King's Highway, okay? All right, so let's talk about some key cities, okay? These are important. As we move forward in the text, we haven't seen a ton of it yet, but Jerusalem is going to become very, very important, right? Right now, we're with Bedouin, we're in the desert. Jerusalem hasn't even hit our radar, okay? Currently, it's occupied by a group of people called the Jebusites. Jebus, you're going to see the text, call the city of Jerusalem. David is going to go in there and occupy that city later on, okay? Why would you want to pick a city, by the way, that's at 2,300 feet elevation? It's at the highest point of basically everything around it, to your west and to your east. Everything drops off dramatically. Why would that be a good city to set up your kingdom if you're King David?
Protection.
That's primarily why he was there. Okay, and I'll tell you a couple of other elements that a city must have, but one of them was protection. So if you're at the top of this city, you can see people coming in for miles, and you have the high ground. So in battle situation, they have to come up to you. So you've got a very fortifiable city, okay? Now, there are three cities to the east, okay? Now think through these lines that I show you. These white lines are valleys and travel routes to those cities. So if you want to get to Jerusalem from the west, you have to travel through one of these valleys, okay? And you're going to travel through one of these cities on the way, okay? So if you're a really, really smart king, like Solomon, and you own a ton of the land, why are these cities specifically important to you? If Jerusalem is your city hub, your center, where all your people live, where your kingdom is, what are you doing with these other cities?
Gateways.
Gateway cities. What does that mean?
Trade routes.
Trade routes? Absolutely trade routes. Okay, so you're going to put goods there, you're going to put supplies there. Okay, so when things are friendly, goods are moving to and from these areas. Okay, Gezer was one of the cities on the Via Maris, not Gezer, Gezer, okay? So that certainly would have been influenced by trade. In times of war, in times when you don't have peace, what are you doing with these cities? If the Philistines want to come attack you from the west,
they're outposts,
okay? So what are you putting there?
Troops,
food, water supplies, ammunition, you know, bows, arrows, slingshots, all that you have, because those cities are there to protect Jerusalem. So you know if you got to get to, you know, the mother lode that is Jerusalem, you've got to go through one, if not all of these cities to get there, okay? So Gezer, Beth Shemesh, Azekah and Lachish are four gateway cities to the west. Now, there's other cities to the north and to the south, okay? But this is how you had to get through Jerusalem. So these are called the gateway cities. I want you guys to write these down. I want you to know these, okay? So on your map, again, they don't have to be perfect. These will not be on the test, okay? These cities won't, but I just want you guys to be familiar with them, okay? Each city is placed in a valley and is strategically located, okay? So Gezer is the northernmost city there. It's what's in the Aalon Valley. You can see on the map, A-I-J-A-L-O-N, okay? Pronounced Aalon Valley, okay? We're going to see this city mentioned in the book of Joshua. You guys remember the story of Joshua chapter 10, where Joshua has to go out to battle to save a group of people. He can't get there in time, so he prays to God that the sun would stand still. Okay, that's where this occurs. So the Aalon Valley and this kind of this area is where God is literally going to cause the sun to stand still for some unknown period of time, so Joshua can make the journey over there in the daylight. Okay, so Gezer, Aalon Valley. Okay, tell you what, let's do this. Okay, the second southern city is Bet Shemesh, okay? You guys remember what Bet means?
Well.
Close. Bet means house, okay? Shemesh means sun. Is that right? Yes, sun. Making sure I got that right, okay? So Bet Shemesh means house of the sun. Bethlehem means house of bread. We talked about that before. Bethlehem, right? So house of bread. So all these words have meanings that are undergirding all the titles, okay? Bet Shemesh is in the Sorek Valley. Sorry, I can get back to the right slide. This is where Samson's from, okay? Sorek means grape, okay? So it's in the Valley of Grapes. So you can obviously guess what's grown in this region are grapes where Samson's from, okay? Azekah. I want you guys to think about David and Goliath. That's the Elah Valley. Okay, the battle between David and Goliath occurs at Azekah in the valley just beneath it called the Elah Valley. Okay, David and Goliath occur in there. 1 Samuel chapter 17, we'll get there in our journey through Samuel. Okay, and the last one is Lachish. Okay, it is in the Lachish Valley, so easy enough. Okay, Sennacherib, who is the king of the Assyrians at the time, we'll read about his story in 1 Kings-ish somewhere. Check that, 2 Kings, when we get to him, okay? So Sennacherib is going to try to come in and lay waste to Jerusalem, and we'll see kind of how that turns out, okay? So that is kind of the southern portion of the land, right? So those are the four of the gateway cities. There's lots more to cover, but that is kind of a brief overview of the geography, okay? So you've got your four territories moving west to east, okay, which are what? Starting in the west next to the Mediterranean Sea, what's that area called? Coastal Plains. Then directly next to that is the Shephelah. Very good. Moving one more east is the mountains, Judah Mountains. Okay, what city's located in there? Jerusalem. Very good. And then one more over to the east, the Judah Wilderness. Very good. Okay, the temptation occurred in that area. And the last area to the east where the Jordan River is? The Rift Valley. Okay, you guys got it. Okay. Sea of Galilee to the north, Jordan River, Dead Sea to the south. Okay. What's at the very bottom, desert area? The Negev, okay? Abraham, Bedouins lived there, okay? So let's go north, okay? And by the way, the land is kind of coolly divided up, not holistically, but a lot of the Old Testament stories occur in this area. When we get up to the north in the Sea of Galilee, a lot of the New Testament stuff occurs up there, okay? So I just want to walk you guys through some of the geography that you'll see up there, okay? So this is the Sea of Galilee. Obviously, you've seen this before. It's a small sea. It is a lake. We would call it a lake from when we're from, right? We have large bodies of water here. This is the biggest they have, so they call it a sea. It's fresh water. It's not salt water. It's a freshwater lake, okay? So, essentially. 14 miles tip to top, okay? 6-7 miles wide. So it's not gigantic, okay? You can see, stand on one side and see the other, okay? It's pretty. It's cool. They do water skiing out there today and all the, you know, the boating activities that you'd imagine with like modern Israelis. They do all that there. Okay.
It's like Shaver Lake.
I don't know how big Shaver is. Mm-hmm. Any idea? I feel like it's bigger than Shaver.
Sorry. Yeah,
Maybe Millington would have some water in it. So, yeah. Okay. So, let me throw you through a couple geographical points on here. And you don't necessarily need to know all these, but I want you to be familiar with just kind of the very distinct living areas, okay? So the first area here, well, let's walk through some of the cities first, okay? So around the lake, around the Sea of Galilee, you've got a couple different areas, okay? Some that you've heard before. Here's Capernaum. This is where Peter, or at least Peter's mother-in-law was from. We think he was probably here as well. Bethsaida means house of the fish over here. Chorazin, woe to you, Chorazin. We see Jesus rebuke that city for their lack of belief in him. This forms what's called the religious triangle that I'll show you guys in a second, but those are kind of some significant landmarks up there. The traditional place where the Mount of Beatitudes is up here, where Jesus gave his speech in Matthew 5 through 7. Blessed are the poor, blessed are the broken in spirit. The Beatitudes speech would have occurred right up here north of the Sea of Galilee. Okay. Magdala is over here. Mary Magdala was from this area. Mount Arbel, big mountain off to the side. When we go to Israel, we visit that. Tiberias is over here. Sounds like a Roman city because it is a Roman city. Today, it is a very modern, if you want to go to the discotheque in Israel, you go to Tiberias, okay? It's a filthy town. We try to stay out of it. It's very Roman. It's what you expect of Rome. It's opulent. It's Rome, okay? On the other side of the sea, you've got Susita. You guys remember, I always call him Crazy Larry. That's what PJ calls him in his sermons. The guy that got healed that was demon-possessed. Got the pigs went down in the sea. This is where Crazy Larry lived. Okay, this is Susita. I wonder what that guy's real name is when we get to heaven. I'm sorry, dude. Someone call you Crazy Larry. Is that okay? I can't remember what you really called. PJ said really? It's Crazy Larry. So it really is Larry. It's a Jewish name. Who knew? Okay. And then you've got Gamla, which is another city up here to the northeast. Okay. What's fascinating about this little area is if you were of a certain belief system, you lived in a very small area and only in that area with your people around a lake. But if you were a pagan, you didn't live where the believers lived. And if you were for Rome, you didn't live in a pagan area. Okay, it's just a bizarre deal, but that's kind of how specific it was. So let me walk you guys through that. Okay, the first area is called the Decapolis. Decapolis literally means 10 cities. Okay, this is where the pagans lived. So the east side of the lake were the pagans. Okay, so if you were Crazy Larry and you worshiped false gods and that was your belief system, you lived out in this area with the other people that shared your belief system. Okay, so the pagans lived out that way. So when Jesus says to his disciples, when they are in Bethsaida or Capernaum, and says, get in the boat, we are going to go to the other side, this is where they're going, right? So in their little world, they live up here, by the way, you would never, ever go over here. That's where the pagans live. That's where the people that are not like us live. Why would we go over there, right? So Jesus is taking his disciples on intentional journeys at times to go over to introduce them to beliefs and concepts and his power over demons, his power over disease, his power over all these things. But this is where he goes, right? So as a Jew, you wouldn't have stepped foot in that land. That's like going to Vegas. Like, ugh, you don't want to go there, okay? So pagans, Decapolis live over there, okay? Tiberias, on the left side, is where the Herodians lived. The Herodians were people that were Jewish, that were loyal to Rome, okay? During Jesus' day specifically, all of Israel was occupied by Rome, okay? Rome had their foot on Israel. So, in order to be able to practice your religion, Rome had to give you authority to do that. In order for them to have like the Day of Atonement or Passover, and the high priest got on the special garments, Rome controlled all those. They had to ask Rome permission for the high priest to put on this deal and for them to have this holiday, okay? There were certain people that liked what Rome brought. Rome, by the way, is brilliant in the way that they come occupy you, okay? They don't just come take you over, kind of like the Assyrians did, and, you know, put your head on a stick and say, look, either you come be with us or we're going to cut your head off and you're going to light my gardens with your flaming head. Rome was like, no, here's what we're going to do. We're going to introduce you to our culture, to our music, to our bathhouses, to our opulence, to our theater. We're going to introduce you to arts and all these really cool things. And as a little Jewish boy that lived in Capernaum or Katzrin, and you were in this little insula, this little small village with your family who had never seen all this stuff, and all of a sudden for the very first time, it's like you're in Paris. And you're seeing all this unbelievable fashion and people and money. What's going on in your inside of you? You're like, man, I want some of that. I want that dress. I want these goods. I want to eat like they do. I want, you know, I want bathhouses and places to exercise and all the stuff that Rome would offer you. So they would just win you over by their opulence, okay? So these were people that lived in this area, primarily that were Jewish, but they were loyal to Rome, okay? So there was a group of, a faction of people during that day that loved Rome, and there's a group of people that hated Rome. The people that hated Rome were called the Zealots. They lived northeast, and they lived in Gamla primarily, okay? The Zealots are the people that you hear about that would walk around in Jerusalem. They would carry daggers, and they'd find a Roman or someone that was loyal to Rome, a Herodian, and just knife them, just cut them, just gut them in the middle of the street and keep walking. Okay? That was kind of their deal. They hated Rome. They hated all that Rome brought. They were uber liberal, conservative in their beliefs, but they went so far to say that the right way to deal with Rome is just kill them. Okay? So if you're loyal to Rome, you deserve death because Rome oppresses us. So those were the Zealots. And you see Jesus speak specifically to this group of people, to the Zealots, and the way that they interpret the law and all those things. Okay, they were crazy nut jobs, but fiercely loyal to Israel and not to Rome. Okay, and then the last group of people lived in what's called the religious triangle. Okay, the cities that I showed you earlier of Bethsaida, Capernaum, and Chorazin. They all were like within a 3-mile distance of each other. And if you were a Jew that was a Torah-believing religious Jew, this is where you lived, in one of those cities primarily. Okay, so very, very distinct in terms of the people groups. The land around it was all beautiful, very different than what's obviously occurring down south. So you live next to a lake. On the west side of the lake over here, you've got big mountains, foothills maybe in our language. Over here in Susita, in that area, you do as well. And then moving north, up to the northern Galilees, the Hula Valley, big lush open land, mostly swamp. It's not a great area, but that's kind of what was up there. But you had very different locations of where you lived, okay? So you lived with people that were like you primarily, okay? Make sense? Okay. And here's the religious triangle again. So Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum. Okay, those are the three cities. Okay, Bethsaida, Chorazin, Capernaum. Obviously, you can see that they form a triangle.
One's over the C and one's over the K.
You know what? Spelling it in transliterating from Hebrew to English is interesting. They have letters in their alphabet that we don't have. Okay, so you have to figure out, how do you spell that? Is it C-H or is it K? And you'll see it spelled differently. Even in Israel, on English signs, you'll see it spelled Chorazin with a K, Chorazin with a C. It's very confusing, okay? I made the statement one time that spelling doesn't matter very much in Israel, and someone rebuked me. He was like, oh no, it matters very much in our language. We just can't figure out how to exactly spell it in yours. So anyway, Katsrin, which is a city up there, sometimes spelled with a Q, sometimes spelled with a K, sometimes spelled with a C. All different signs in Israel. Like, man, can you guys just pick one, right? I can't spell as it is, so you're not helping me. So, which is good, because I can say, well, this is just one other way to spell it, right? So it's Mike's way. So, religious triangle up there, okay? So, look at those moving parts. You're so fascinated, aren't you? Okay, there's the triangle, 3 to 3.5 miles apart in each one of those cities, just to give you an idea, okay? So here's a little bit of, you know, my iPhone 4 footage. I know you're wowed and impressed. Okay, this is Chorazin. So I talked about up north. You asked earlier, like, where they lived and what they lived in. This is the basalt stone. This is the black stone. This is an actual village, okay, that has been unearthed. So each one of these walls would have been a room. Walls would have been extended, obviously, much higher. But this is a town. So when we talk about, like, the scope and the size of a town, this is a piece of Chorazin, okay, one of the cities in the triangle up there, okay? So you can see different elements in here. This little box over here, I will buy someone an ice cream if they know what that is. Little small box you've got. It's kind of hard to see in context. Not for you, Sean. Where's Tessa? Damn, she's not here either. She should know what that is, okay? I'll give you a hint, okay? Some of these areas that we're looking at specifically where they would have stored some of the animals.
A manger.
This is a manger. So when you think about what Jesus was put in, this is a manger. I got a close-up picture of it. It's stone, okay? When you think about Jesus living in this area, by the way, and he is a carpenter, the word is tekton in the Greek, They don't have wood. Very, very little wood. Highly unlikely that Joseph was a guy that worked with wood. He would have worked with what they would have had available in his region, which would have been stone. Joseph was a stonemason, which if you've ever laid brick, you've ever done work with stone, it is hard. It is difficult, laborious work. So Jesus, more than likely, was a stonemason like his father, adopted father, Joseph. Okay?
Jesus was a mason?
More than likely, yeah, he was a mason. Careful with the use of that word. What's that?
I want that ice cream.
You got it. I'll buy you an ice cream. Okay? You buy me lunch, and I'll buy you an ice cream. I'll buy an ice cream. Okay? This is also at Chorazin. What is this? Anybody got an idea?
A bunch of people chilling.
Totally. Okay? So, we are in the religious triangle. We have a high view of God. Okay? We've got a city or an insula. And then this is a large room that's in every one of the religious triangle villages.
Temple?
Not a temple. There's only one temple, but you're going down the right road. It's a synagogue. Okay? What's a synagogue for? Worship. Okay, this is their church. Okay? This is where you would have a worship service, and this is also where you would have school. This is where you would take your kids to instruct them. This is the town school. Okay? Pillars and stuff like that. Okay? This obviously would have wrapped all the way around. Big area, open. Okay? Seats on the side. You can see these are seats over there.
Is that Andrew right there?
That's Rich Ferreira. That's Doc Hansen. Jeff Bachman, if you guys know him. That really good looking guy right back there is me. The smoking hot wife, Michelle. That's my wife. The do-rag. So that's, yeah. We were all like melting. But okay, that's a synagogue. I'll show you another picture later, okay? This is more of the same, okay? So you just get an idea of the ruins and that sort of thing, okay? See if my video shows up here.
How long did you guys have to walk?
So when you think town, that's the whole town, okay? That's it. So when you think of a city and Jesus says, woe to Chorazin, you're talking about a couple hundred people, maybe 500, okay? Probably more like 200 to 300 people that would have lived there, right? And the way it would happen is, right, I'm married, okay? Sean's my son, and he's ready to get married. I find him a bride. I meet with her dad, husband to husband or man to man. We talk. We work this thing out. Great. Sean is now going to build a house next to mine. He's going to add on to my house while this gal waits and is kind of awaiting the home to be finished. And then when Sean finishes his house, I give it approval. This gal would now come and live in our insula, in our community. We live there. And then when Sean becomes a father, so on and so forth, you would just build on to your houses. A lot of the houses, even today in Israel, that's what happens. You get a house that's built, and all of a sudden there's like this really weird addition to it, and then another addition. Houses are always under construction in Israel, especially specific areas, but that's how you grew. Like, you got married, you didn't just like go, hey, I'm out, pops. I'm moving 500 miles away to wherever. No, you lived at home. And you built on your family's house, and you literally, like, you shared a wall with mom and dad who were next door where you grew up. And your wife would move into that world with you. And then so on and so forth, and that's how an area grew. So you're talking about a couple hundred people, synagogue, really, really simple living, right? They didn't have a lot. That's life in the religious triangle, okay? Pretty cool. Okay, this is Capernaum, okay? What is this? You just saw it? Synagogue, okay? What do you notice that's different about it? It's bigger. This is one of the biggest synagogues in all of Israel. It's gigantic. What color is the rock? Kind of whitey pink. This is limestone, okay? So this is what is available in that area. Now, 3.5 miles apart, and this is the change in geography, right? What rock was available? They had limestone. They used limestone, okay?
Basalt.
Basalt, yeah. Okay? This is a very, very Catholic site. It is owned by the Catholic Church, okay? So in the next picture I show you, you're going to see something that doesn't look right, and that's why, okay? So here are all the ruins of Capernaum. And then above it, they built what we heretics like to call the spaceship. Okay, this is a church above the Catholic this site. Okay, and they literally have worship services in there. So when you go to Israel and you go to Capernaum, which is where Peter's mother-in-law was from, they built on top of this site a place where they could worship. Now, to their credit, it looks way out of sorts, but they did elevate it above all the ruins so that you can still walk underneath. And somewhere in there, this is where Peter probably grew up, and his mother-in-law, his wife was probably from here, and you can walk around the city. Much, much bigger, okay? Maybe a couple thousand people lived in Capernaum. Again, White Rock, you can see the outlines of all their houses and that sort of thing. So that's kind of the idea there, all right? So these are cities in Israel. Simple, synagogue attached to it, simple living as a religious Jew. Those are the things that got elevated.
Are all those walls that are split, those are each houses, like next to each other, just kind of clipped onto each other?
Not necessarily a house. That would be a room in a house. Okay, so this, for instance, may be a kitchen, you know, and maybe you got a bedroom over here. Okay, and again, those walls are, you know, they're like waist high, maybe up to your chest. But they would have been obviously much higher with a thatch roof on top of it. One of the cities we go to took this concept, took all the stones that had fallen and rebuilt the city. Fascinating. With the original rocks and then put on a natural roof. So you can literally walk through a home that would have been just like Jesus lived in. The village is 2nd century, not 1st century. But nothing had really changed in terms of how they built that sort of thing. So it's really cool to see where they lived. And it's tight. I mean, no private rooms, right? You had a living room, and when it wasn't a living room, that was your bedroom, you know, and then when it wasn't your bedroom, it was the kitchen the next morning. Mom and dad maybe slept upstairs in like a little loft. There ain't a lot of privacy, but it's different. Really, really cool to see.
This is real similar to the tent camps that were in Lebanon. Just the way they set it up and like the communities that they are established.
Yeah.
But the question I had originally before you make the mention is like these walls, were they excavated to the floor, like this is the actual height of mm-hmm. it, or was more like added with wood or branches to elevate the walls?
So that's the original floor level. The wall that you see is the original, but the rest of the rocks have fallen off the top. So those rocks would have been, those walls would have been at least twice as high.
Okay.
For sure. Yeah. But through time and battles and whatever, cities getting destroyed, they've died down. Now, this is kind of cool as well. This is all of Israel, okay? You see what are called tells all over Israel. A tell is simply a hill with layers and layers of history underneath it, right? So at the bottom layer, you've got the first civilization that lived there because they found a place that was great to live. Well, somebody comes in, destroys the city, lies in ruins, and another people group comes in and says, hey, location, 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 this is still a great place to live. Let's build on top of them. They build their civilization. They're there for hundreds of years. They get destroyed, right? So you've got this layer cake of civilization. So one of the big debates in Israel is how far down do you dig, right? So if you want to dig and see the history of this area, that's great. But you've got more history underneath it. So what happens if you want to get to this history? Well, you have to destroy all the history above it. What's more important? How do you make those decisions? So archaeologists have to do that all the time. Here's a dig in Megiddo where they literally dig in this gigantic downward spiral. So you would get one civilization and then another and then another and another. It was really cool. So they would piece it together. So they would keep certain parts of one and then keep digging down. It's fascinating. And some of these tells are hundreds of feet tall and each layer has a different civilization. Now, it's weird to think about that. We've been here, you know, in the States for like a couple hundred years. You're talking about, in some of these areas, 6,000 years of history. You go back to Abraham's day, who's in the land, I'm sorry, not 6,000, 4,000 years of history. In 2100 BC to modern day history, you've got these gigantic gaps that we can't comprehend of how many. So, crazy, okay? Here's what a tell looks like. You guys remember the four gateway cities? Gezer, Bet-Shemesh, Azekah, Lachish. This is Lachish. That is Tel Lachish. Built up on a hill, and there would have been layers in there. You get to the top of the hill, and there's this gigantic city that's up there. Gigantic meaning a couple hundred people, right? Fortified, all these things, okay? So that's what maybe a city would look like. So as you're driving around Israel, and you see elevated places like that, you know this is where people live, okay? Now, the reason they lived there were these reasons, okay? If you're going to live somewhere in Israel, you need, obviously, a defensible location. We see that as the third one on there that we talked about. That's why you would pick Jerusalem or what have you. But you obviously need water, some type of water source. You need food, and you need a trade route. You need some way to trade. And if you found an area of land that had all four of those things, they never change, right? So if you can grow food in an area, if you've got water available in an area, those things are constant. If you've got high ground and you pick an area like that and you will make it defensible, and if it happens to be on the Via Maris or close to it or the King's Highway, you've got a way to get the goods and services that you need so you can buy stuff, you can sell stuff, so on and so forth, okay? So.
How would they know, I guess it's not an archaeologist question, but how would they know that one city would stop and then the next one would go and then,
based on the types of artifacts that they find, they can date them based on what instruments of warfare they're using. Are they more advanced? Are they simpler? The pottery that they see there, bones, the way people are buried, they can even tell. So, yeah, it's crazy how they figure that out. Yeah, what they value in those things. So one of the things like at Bet Shemesh that you see is different layers. In one layer, you would see they dug basically through their garbage outside of what maybe would have been a kitchen. And they would see in one layer a ton of pig bones. And then a layer above it, you would see virtually no pig bones. What would that tell you about who lived there? If you saw a ton of pig bones in the Shephelah, who lived there?
Gentiles,
not Jews, right? Because pigs are unclean. And then if you go a layer up and you see, like, no pig bones, Jews, right? Because they're obeying the law. So stuff like that, you're like, oh, that's fascinating. And then when you get into a layer that you know is Israeli and you see, or Hebrew, and you see 30% king bones during a king's reign that you know lived during that time, and this would have been their occupation, but this king in the Bible is talked about being somewhat committed to God, but not so much committed to God, which you see is compromise. He let in some pig bones, and yet, you know, it's just there's fascinating ways to see how the city was and what they valued. Were they Torah believing? Were they not? So archaeology is really, really cool. Okay, so anyway, so that's the orientation I wanted to give you. I was going to get into some Jerusalem stuff. We won't get into a ton of that. The city in and of itself, there's a ton going on in that city itself. But what you need to know about Jerusalem is it's very divided in terms of corridors and sectors today and then. There's a Muslim quarter, a Jewish quarter, a Christian quarter, and an Armenian quarter. Meaning, if you were Muslim, you live in the Muslim quarter. If you're a Christian, you do not live in the Jewish quarter. You set up shop, live, trade, whatever, and you can interact between them. But you walk through them, and it's like walking in these really narrow alleys. And all of a sudden, you pass through like a gate, and all of a sudden, you're in a whole nother quarter with different culture, different values, different smells, different stuff that they're cooking, different stuff that they're selling. Fascinating. Okay, so Jerusalem is a hopping city even today.
So
okay?
As tourists, are you guys allowed to travel through each of those?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep, they're safe and easy to travel through. And it's just fascinating to see all the different deals.
Going up to the temple is just the hard part?
Yeah, the temple is interesting. Okay, so there's the temple. Get a bit of an idea. So Temple Mount is here. Okay, this is modern day, and you can kind of see outlines of different deal. This would have been the old city, kind of David when he built his Jerusalem. That's where it's going to be. Currently, the Temple Mount is Muslim controlled. They have the rights to that, but everything is protected by the Jews. So you see armed guards walking around, Israeli police with submachine guns and whatever. They're the protectors, but the Temple Mount itself is controlled by the Muslims. So they allow people to come up there and see it. They don't mind tourists being up there. There's certain days they won't allow you to. So during their holy days, Friday night, Saturday, you don't go up there. But you can go and walk around. You don't talk about Yahweh up there. You don't pray up there. You don't talk about Jesus up there. So you have to be very, very careful.
So you can evangelize outside of that, around that.
Yeah, and even tell them the stories. Like, Ronan will be up there, and he's like, okay, if we see somebody, all of a sudden I'm going to start talking about Muhammad and his camels. Mm-hmm. And he'd be literally in a story about Jewish history, and all of a sudden we're all kind of like this facing him, and he looks up and he's like, and the Muhammad had these six camels that were, you're like, what just happened? Well, you realize someone's walking up, so you just have to be very careful. The Muslims do not like Jews walking up there. So like that gets pretty tense. So most Jews don't go up there for the sake of not creating tension. The prime minister of Israel went up there a number of years ago and about set off the Third World War, literally, because of just the anger and the outrage. And so, yeah, it is a very tense, interesting environment. But we can go up there. It's fascinating. It's really cool to be up there. But what you see is the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. You see two Muslim shrines and a gigantic complex where people would used to come worship that was the Temple Mount, but none of it looks like it did, obviously, back in the day. So, different deal, okay? So, I want you guys to, I know that's a lot. I know it's like kind of drinking from a fire hose. I don't expect you guys to memorize this, but you're going to see that this geography matters in the text. And you should begin to read about things and understand stuff. And when you're reading and you're seeing in the Gospels, when Jesus is talking about the city of Chorazin, you go, oh, that's where the religious Jews were. Jesus rebuked them. These should have been people that understood who the Messiah was, and they missed it. Jesus isn't rebuking people that live in Susita who were pagans who had no idea who God was, right? He's rebuking people that have been followers of the Torah for 2,000 years, and they don't understand Jesus. Ooh, that's bad. That's why Jesus is more upset with them than the grace that he extends to Crazy Larry. You don't expect Crazy Larry to know him. He lives in the Decapolis, right? The cities of the pagans, so on and so forth. Okay, so these things will clue you into other stuff that's happening in the text. So again, Rich Ferreira walked me through all this for the first time 5 or 6 years ago, and I was like mesmerized that never in seminary, never in all the schooling I had, had anybody walked me through the significance of the geography of Israel, because it matters. Okay, so as you guys read the text, as you begin to see some of these words pop off, you go, oh yeah. Azekah, what does that matter? Oh, that's where David and Goliath fought, and so on and so forth, okay? So, questions about any of that I can answer? We're going to kind of call that a day, now that we have all the 5 minutes left, so we won't start Joshua today, but we're ahead of schedule. Not anymore, but I was able to sneak this in, so. Thoughts or questions before we're done?
Oh, man, that was good.
Cool. All right, guys, enjoy your weekend, be safe. We will see you on Thursday. Until then, peace to you.
I was gonna say,
but I'm not gonna say.
I'm really serious about Saturday.
Is
today
one of the kids? I was gonna say how realistic is he speaking, like being into
parents'
house, like being into their lives, as in like you know. Pick them up for church. I don't know. How realistic is that? Has that happened? Is that hard to?